Welcome to episode 13 of the Drawn Today podcast, where we encourage you to draw every day. A few of our Drawn Today members attended the gaming convention Gen Con last month, and in this episode they, along with some very special guests, talk about what it's like to attend as an artist.
All right, guys, so this is the Drawn Today podcast Gen Con special. We've got a few Drawn Today folks on the line, and we've also got some special guests. Let's start, everybody just go around, introduce yourselves, and give us your website. Let's start with Grant.
My name is Grant Cooley. My work, among other places, can be found at www.grantcooley.com.
And Lars.
My name is Lars Grant West. I'm at larsgrantwest.com, or my old website is.
And Eric.
Hi, this is Eric Deschamps. My website is ericdeschamps.com.
Aaron.
Hello, my name's Aaron Miller, and my website is aaronbmiller.com.
The soon to be released new website.
That's right.
And my name is Mark Sheff. You can find me at markscheff.com. So a bunch of us went to Gen Con. Grant, Aaron, you guys are Drawn Today podcast veterans, and we were all at Gen Con. We were all in the Artist Alley together. Feel free to jump in wherever, guys, but first, for those of us it was our first Gen Con, what was your general impression?
Great show.
Balls.
I had a good time. I expected to have a good time. There were too many friends there not to have a good time.
Eric, this was your first one?
Yep, first time ever. I'd never been to it, so it was definitely pretty cool. It was a little bigger than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah,
I had a great time.
Have you done other cons?
I went to the San Diego Comic Con, but that was just attending. And I've done a bunch of Magic events and a LuxCon. And I think that's pretty much it. A LunaCon and BossCon. So, but only LunaCon and BossCon did I actually show work. I've never shown it. Obviously, you know, Comic-Con, they don't have that type of thing there. But, yeah. This sucks. I'm totally not good at this kind of thing. I had to cut this out. Like, I feel so awkward doing this.
we'll just keep your name at the intro, and that'll be it.
I'm opening with that. Are you kidding me? Lars, you've done a bunch of cons, right?
Well, Gen Con's probably the biggest that I've done. I've never gone to San Diego Comic-Con, although I thought about doing it. I've been asked to do it by some friends for quite some time, but I've never done it. Gen Con I did for the first time in 2000 and I think 2001 as well. And then I stopped going for a few years, and I decided to come back again this year because a client was going to be there. And it's always a lot of fun. I think there are more costumes this year and a lot more artists and a lot higher quality work than I remember seeing the first time I was there.
I was really impressed. I was also really impressed with the quality. I've only been to this is Mark. I'm only sort of getting into the con thing. And I've been to BossCon and WorldCon and actually sort of mostly fan cons. And my impression is that and I was trying to explain this to my wife. There's basically three kinds of cons. You know, there's the fan cons like BossCon and WorldCon, which is, you know, they're run by the fans, they're for the fans. There's definitely artists there, and the artists are definitely honored there, but the focus is sort of the genre as a whole. And then there's like a LuxCon, which is really all about the illustrators. There's workshops for illustrators, by illustrators. You can learn from, there's art directors there. You know, it's a great time. And then there's stuff like Gen Con, which is sort of like an overall industry con, and my impression was that everybody's there for, God, like a billion different reasons. You may or may not be a fan of the genre. You could be an artist who, you know, has never played any of these games. You could be a gamer who has never given a crap about the art. You know, there's people who are there for all kinds of reasons, and it was just neat to see everybody kind of all in one place.
It's always a lot of fun to see the people who are clearly not there for the convention. You know, maybe parents who have brought their kids, or, you know, the average kid or something walking through and just sort of looking around, kind of amazed at what's going on. And little bit like somebody visiting from another planet and just trying to figure things out. But the whole convention environment is always a lot of fun.
I almost felt that way just walking around and between breaks from my booth or my table, whatever. I think it'll take a few years to actually understand what I could even do there if I decide to take a break.
Well, that actually brings me to another question, and Grant, maybe you can jump in on this one. This was the first time for a bunch of us having tables at Gen Con, and for some of us, any con ever. What was your impression? What was your sort of takeaway from having a table? Maybe start with you, Grant.
Well, for those that don't know, I have started touring the con circuit this year, doing mostly genre shows. Did one comic show to start it off. A lot of genre shows throughout the Southeast, which is what you were referring to as fan cons. Whether it's a literary con, a relaxicon, doesn't matter. There are a number of different types and sizes, ranging from 250 in attendance to a couple of thousand. So going to Gen Con was really cool for the attendance numbers. However, I do these shows, and I have had a variety of responses to my work, which is really just getting started. But you have a whole different response when you have a smaller environment. You get much more exposure. You get people that are there to look at everything at the show, whereas at Gen Con, you had so many more people that were there specifically for what they wanted, something they were specifically interested in, and everything else was a sightseeing. So you maybe had 30,000 people there, but you really probably, I would hazard a guess, you only had a couple hundred people there who were even interested in what the Artist Alley was about. We had a lot more foot traffic than that, but most of it was very casual, and the people that saw more time, exposure, and attendance at their booths were the people who had recognizable work that were
On the WIP podcast, I think Jeremy McHugh called it the conveyor belt of indifference.
Yeah, it's a really good term for it, because they've already gone, seen a couple booths. They're taking a break from playing, or they're taking a break from checking out vendors. The other side that's funny, I do these shows. I have done a number of different size things, but I also still, although I don't have much involvement with it now, I still own a comic and game store that I was an active gamer in for 6-7 years, having played most of the games, but those genre games, sci-fi, fantasy, strategy games, miniature games, all these things, having played those for almost 20 years, owning a shop for 6 or 7 years, then going to an event like this that I didn't have time to go to before and attend because I was running the shop, but seeing all of these vendors, seeing the games that are coming out, seeing the people's response to them, identifying and knowing who those people are, why they're there, and then almost lamenting the fact that I know who they are, I know why they're there, and it's not to see me. So,
is that really true? I mean, my impression was not so different from yours, and this is great. We can get back to disagreeing, but was it really true that the people who didn't have a lot of, say, magic card art? What I hear you saying is, if you have magic card art games that people recognize, you get a lot of foot traffic. And that's certainly true. I saw, Eric, you had a lot of traffic, and Lars, you had a lot of traffic, people looking to sign cars, people looking for playmats, people looking for prints of the work that they loved, even some originals.
Because sometimes it's not even about the artwork. You know, sometimes it's not even about the artwork. If somebody loves the card and loves playing with that card, it could be your worst piece, and you're going to sell all kinds of copies of that. So that's a big part of it.
Yeah, and I think Eric can relate to this as well, that doing the magic events, and magic is primarily what I do events for, you end up running into people who are very specific, very focused about what they're interested in. And yeah, sometimes it isn't about the art at all. It's about the mechanics of the card. And, you know, this card's won me a match or whatever. And it's great to go to one of these conventions. It's a little bit more general, and you find people really interested in specific aspects of your work in particular. And I do think that the more you do the events, the more you sort of get this facial recognition. You have people that come back year after year, and sometimes you'll have someone who might not buy something the first year, might not be interested in particular, but after spending time talking to you individually, they not only like your art, but they start to get a feel for who you are as a person. And So that time chatting people up is really worth it.
Yeah, it sure is.
Well, yeah. And that's actually a really good point to make talking about going to any shows, because that's true really at almost any level. I suppose, you know, the Todd Lockwoods and Michael Whalens and everything like that will have such a wide exposure for such a long period of time that they're going to get what they're going to get. But it's the repetition. I've heard that. It's so many different shows. Well, we want you to come back next year. Well, how were sales? Okay, well, you got to understand a lot of these people buy because they like you. They may like the work, but they want to really get to know you. These people buy originals, but they only really like to buy originals from people that they know or feel like they're going to know, that kind of thing. So it's to do the con circuit. I've heard so many times when, you know, I get discouraged pretty frequently. A lot of these things can be a real mind job, but you meet a lot of cool people, and those people will invariably say, well, you've got to come back. They have to get to know you. I guarantee you come back, you're going to expect an increase in sales, notoriety, people coming up and talking to you. And of course that is true, but it's just whether or not you go, well, is it really worth it for me to build up that particular fan base? In the case of doing major shows, garnering more magic fans, more art fans from your initial magic impetus, that's probably an easier call. But doing genre shows and specific shows, I don't know if I think that's going to be a regional, and what were the sales like to begin with? But good point. Good point on the I can't even. I'm having a brain fart on the right term, but on the persistence of attendance and showing.
Well, yeah.
You know, that brings up another question, which is, and feel free to jump around, guys. I know I'm moving sort of quickly through our quote unquote agenda, but who would you recommend have a table? I know that I kind of went in blind this year because a bunch of people were going, and I thought, what the hell, I'll go and do it. But, you know, we're talking about it's better for certain people and not others. Should anyone have a table? What kind of artist should have a table?
I think it depends on what it is they want to get out of the convention that they're actually going to.
Meaning what?
Well, so far we've been talking about, you know, we just mentioned sale. But we're not getting to selling what, such as like originals. People aren't coming to, say, Gen Con to purchase an original. I think what has to be determined for someone to show up is what it is they want out of it and what they have to offer. And if it's, say, like prints, then they'll probably do fine. But then it comes down to prints of what. And then there's originals, where we've mentioned IlixCon, and the people that go there are very interested in original artwork.
Yes.
Whereas I could tell from Gen Con that while they appreciated looking at my paintings, they certainly weren't interested in purchasing one.
Well, except for the two that you sold.
No, those were canvas prints.
Yeah, but they were, I mean, this gets into a whole other thing about, like, what is an original. You had some very, very nice, very unique-looking prints of your work. It was on canvas. It was, in many respects, indistinguishable from, you know, an original, especially if it was hanging on a wall a couple feet away. You probably couldn't tell. So maybe some of the people who are looking for originals aren't really necessarily looking for an original, but something that looks like that.
Well, the price point probably helped, too.
Yeah.
Price point thing is huge, and that's that you run into. I don't mean to jump on you. But let me just jump in here for a second.
Yeah, please.
I think that the having material that covers a range of price points, so that you're not only that you're accessible to collectors, you've got sort of some high ticket items, but you've also got things that are sort of farther down the scale, even down to free. It's important to have, you know, the business cards with some nice illustration on it, or postcards that are just there to sort of be picked up at will, and people can grab a couple and move on. But that's advertising. That's an advertising expense.
Though we've been talking about this at various conventions, the idea of having that free thing in terms of what it is people are looking for and how they're looking for it and where they're at. So almost everything there is I can't think of the right word, where it's just an impulse buy. You know, people aren't coming to that convention always looking for something specific, especially in the artist alley. Mm-hmm. And if you've got something for free, you've instantly gratified that need to have something of yours. And so that was the one thing I was experimenting with. I had no business cards out. I had them, but all they had to do was ask, and I handed them out. But that way it didn't compete with my... I had little tiny prints for sale that were about the same size as a business card. And
How did those do?
I had purchased those for a previous convention, and they paid for themselves in about 15 minutes. So okay. It was all gravy this time, just having them, but I just kind of wanted to go through them. But what I had noticed over the weekend was people are interested in certain images, and they were willing to buy it, but they were looking down the scale to find the cheapest version that I had.
Right.
And if I didn't have it in that little tiny print, but I had an 8x10, they bought the 8x10. If I didn't have it in the 8x10, but I had my super big one, and that was the only one I had, then, you know, they thought about it, but then they come back and bought it. So
I've heard mixed advice on that. I mean, some people are saying, and I even heard before I went, some people saying, you know, Gen Con, go big. Eric, I know you were selling a lot of pretty big prints, right?
Yeah, I wasn't doing too much of the 8x10s. I kind of like had a couple of them that I ran off of my home printer that were just like my more popular ones, but maybe only like two copies each. Had them there. And I just, you know, most of the time, if you're like, oh, I don't have any of those left, they'll usually just buy the bigger piece. So, especially if the price difference isn't huge.
I'd have to agree with that, definitely. I used to go with a ton of 8.5x11 prints, and I still bring those to Magic events because you do have younger kids who maybe don't have a lot of money who are there, and it's nice to have something that's in that sort of $10, $12 price range, which is usually where I sell that size print. But there are some pieces that the more popular pieces that if you're selling them in 13x19, which is what my printer does, or in that range, then people will buy them. And if you're doing a deal like, you know, 25 each, 2 for $40, something like that, you'll oftentimes have people just say, hey, I'll pick up an extra just to save the, you know, I'm getting a deal here.
And yeah, I found that to be very true. The whole upsell thing, when you say upsell, it sort of starts to sound like, oh, I don't want to be a salesman. That's kind of gross. But like, really, a lot of people were very happy when they were like, I really, you know, they'd sort of toss around the idea, and I'd be like, you know, I'll throw in an 8x10 for an extra $5, give you a deal. And a lot of people were like, hey, that sounds great, actually. I was kind of eyeing that other one anyway, and you're giving me a deal, and that feels good to everybody.
Sure.
Try not to price myself, you know, out of any profit at all. I try to at least break even if I'm giving away too much. But, you know, people are happy to sort of tack something on if they feel like they're getting a deal. That's for sure.
Another thing that I didn't see as much of this year, but I saw some, but it's been much more popular in past years too, was these sort of hand put together sketchbooks where somebody will take sketchbooks, have them sketchbook drawings and have them printed out on 1117 paper and get them bound into like an oak tag cover or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They make those made up at Kinko's or they'll just have the sheets copied and then staple them together by hand and bring a whole bucket load of those things, and they will pay for the convention on something like that, selling it for $10-$15.
Yeah.
Those small sales can really pay for your expenses very quickly.
Well, that's actually a good point from beginning congoers or beginning artists to maybe don't have a wide range of published work, any published work, even a real sizable variety in their portfolio. I sell everything. I've got postcards that are basically free that I sell for $3 just for lugging them around and everything like that. I sold a lot of those at this event, and it was to people, most of the people that bought that, it wasn't that sale that I've got to have something of yours. They saw the image walking by. They didn't even ask if I had it in a print. They just wanted the small thing to go on their fridge. They wanted the magnet. They wanted this because that's all they wanted. They didn't they don't really care about having art. I know a lot of the people I've met on the circuit, the fans, they go, well, I really like an original. I don't really buy prints anymore because why am I going to spend more on the framing and all of this for a print when I could just have this? I liked that image. I wanted that. And, you know, true, they didn't even ask how much the postcards were. They're like, I've got to have this. How much is it? Okay, yeah, here. Which isn't always the normal response, but I have the wide range because I'm trying to, as you said, those small sales, it can make a difference. I know Pete Morbacher was saying, I don't have anything in my booth that's under $20. And I understand the logic behind that, but at the same time, if I have something that didn't cost me anything and or hardly cost me anything at all, and it's an image that people would want at that particular size, but probably not a print, I'm going to have it. You may lose out on some of the $12 difference or the more than that if they were, oh, I really liked you. I really wanted to buy something, but I can't afford it. They don't feel pushed into that other thing like, well, I can just get this. And you're like, sure, knock it out. No big deal. Hopefully it was a good conversation.
Well, one thing I want to clarify for the fans who are listening is that when Grant says didn't cost me anything, it didn't cost anything to print. It cost a lot of time.
Oh, yeah. I hope the syntax would be inherent, but there is no such thing as anything free on our end. People that get a card, we had to pay for the business card for you to go home and throw it in your recycling bin.
I had to spend 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours, 50 hours making that painting, or the hundreds of hours it took me making crappy paintings so that I could make that one decent one.
Well, and even the inherent cost. When I say it didn't cost anything, if you're getting something printed on canvas that costs you $200, that's a sizable investment to turn around. Yeah. If I'm out a dollar and I sell it for $3, I'm out 50 cents, I sell it for $3. I'm out $5 and sell it for $15. That's just because you have to buy that. You know, I put in 20-30 hours on the painting, and here I'm good to go. And for all the fans who are like, "You're a liar," I'd be like, "Well, eat it."
Well, sometimes we don't always include all the overhead either because it's invisible, like the parking and hotel and food.
Well, even being there, you know, we spent $300 some odd to have a booth. That's a sizable cost to bring you a $5 mailer, you know, or something like that. That there's all those business costs are what go into that one little sale.
I'll say this though. It was my first time at Gen Con. It was my first time having a booth really at any con, except for AluxCon last year. I did the sort of ad hoc student show last year, and as a relative unknown in the game world, I mean, I've been doing stuff for Fantasy Flight and AEG, but my stuff hasn't been published yet, so people don't know who I am. I'm a relative unknown. The 8x10s really saved my butt. Because there were a lot of people, you know, a lot of people who were coming by who didn't know my work, but they liked something. They weren't. I sold some of the bigger prints, but mostly I sold 8x10s, and that paid for my table. And it's because it's like, you know, it's back to everything what Lars was saying, is that, you know, people like me, we had a good conversation. They wanted to have something, but you know, they didn't want to buy the big print. They didn't want to buy the framed gallery print. They didn't want to buy that stuff, but they wanted to have something. So that's, as a new con attendee, that 8x10 really, really saved the day for me.
Right. And I think that hook, having that hook is a huge thing too. Sometimes it doesn't matter if you're doing magic, if you're doing whatever genre, whatever particular market or brand you're working for. Having an image that really draws people in can totally supersede that. You might have a magic image or just a personal image. And I find a lot of times the personal images are the ones that really hit home for people will pull people in from across the room.
Yeah. It did for me.
Don't underestimate the value of having something that you spent a lot of time on that will, you know, that will probably keep making you money for years and years.
Yeah, I'd have to say, because Mark brought up the idea of us talking, and this is getting out to someone who might be considering this, and I guess the one
considering going
as a table goer, the one piece of advice that I picked up from this convention and my first one at C2E2 this year was that everyone asks what should they have in their portfolio. So there's the building a few pieces of your portfolio to fit the genre you want to work in, obviously, and then pushing it a little further, maybe to fit some of the styles of a specific vendor, like Wizards of the Coast or Paizo or something like that. And then there's the next piece where it's kind of the general genre piece that the new person, I think, could really benefit from. And it was Jeff Himmelman who I had gotten the reminder from, and Tyler Walpole, who I originally got the idea from when I met him at C2E2, where he does a lot of genre art, but he made sure to paint himself a Hulk and something else for the comic convention. Maybe it was a Doctor Doom or Doctor Strange.
He had a Hulk, yeah.
Right. So that fits the people who are looking at your work. He instantly drew people in because he did something specific to the audience. And Jeff Himmelman paid for his table, he said, with his Cthulhu piece. And and that's something that's just a general piece that anyone could put in their portfolio. So that's something that
you're saying people should make sure do. You do art. If you're going to do cons and you want to make money at cons, make sure to do art that's relevant to the audience.
Right.
So for a LuxCon, like Lars was saying, you know, bring originals. For Gen Con, game art. For comic book cons, Hulks, Captain Americas, stuff like that.
Right. At least try and give your audience something. That person just walking around, like my Angel piece, paid for so much of that weekend. And I just did that for myself.
It's a great piece.
Just be cautious, though, also, if you're going, for example, to a comic convention and you're bringing art that is, you want to do print sales, for example, and you're bringing, say, Hulk pictures or something like that, just be aware that technically is copyright violation. And while it's unlikely to happen, you could get nailed for that if you start making a ton of money on these things. And I don't know that Marvel or DC are aggressive about those things, but you'd run into some issues if you were doing, say, Lucasfilm property.
Yeah, definitely don't do any of that. Those are horror stories on the con circuit about what falls into cease and desist and what turns into a lawsuit immediately. And LucasArts, Lucasfilm, none of it. I've got a few Star Wars pieces I did just for fun because I liked it, and I don't even show them at shows, make prints. They're actually just kind of hanging up here now because there's no way to distribute those. So,
right. I think technically you're allowed to, if it's one piece, if it's an original painting, if it's a digital piece that is possibly one of a million prints, then you run into an issue. I'm not certain of that, but I'm
pretty original. Sure. Yeah, I think, well, I don't know. I guess we'd have to look it up. But I think if you have an original piece, like Grant, I know you sold a Wonder Woman a while back, and that was an original piece, which I think is different from making merchandise.
Things that fall under fan art, it's one-offs. Prints actually fall under the radar. If you start making a certain amount of money, certain amount of publication and distribution, they'll send you a cease and desist letter, and that's it. You're done. No big deal from particular artists' mouths. Lucas, though, just has a reputation for gunning first and dealing with whatever afterwards. So they're just completely intolerant of anything other than you can do sketches, fan art, things like that. I suppose because you're doing it at the show on site as a
service
like that. And
service.
Yeah, but even then, it's just like, oh, I'll do people in costume. If they want to be dressed up, you know, if they're dressed up in Boba Fett or they want to be in that costume, but any of the licensed characters, likenesses, things like that, all of that, Boba Fett technically is just a Mandalorian costume. You know, just a word of caution out there. You go, well, I think I can do this because everybody else says Dark Horse is cool. That doesn't apply to Lucas.
just don't go out and spend a lot of money getting 500 prints made of a piece that you just did of Luke Skywalker.
That's a bad idea, yeah. So I got another question for the con going, folks. And again, and this goes back to something Aaron said. You know, we are talking to a lot of people who are trying to, you know, figure out how to do this or trying to learn from our experiences. A couple questions. One, what would you do differently next year as opposed to something that you did this year or didn't do this year? And I'll get to the next question later.
I can tell you the first big thing for me, part of it this year, part of my issue this year was I ended up signing up to go late. So I got a shorter table and I didn't have room for my 13 by 19 prints. And what sometimes happens is you'll have a stack of prints on the table and people won't bother to look through them. So having a rack of some kind that people can flip through, so it's comfortable to flip through your images, is a really good thing to have. I think, Eric, did you have something there that was a box or something that you had so people could flip through things?
Well, I think that was Matt next to me. He had one of those little stands. And he had all his prints in there, which was cool. But I had two portfolios, basically duplicate portfolios of all my work that you purchase, and people could flip through that. And then I just had all this stuff behind me.
I think that's a good tip, just a way for people to see that there's more than just the one image on the table. Like if you've got a stack of 13 by 19s, that people don't necessarily assume that they're all different. But if you've got there's something to flip through, then we'll come over and want to see what's behind the curtain.
Well, that actually works two ways. I will be at Dragon Con. I will be having a felt-covered box for people to flip through. It has original drawings. It has prints in the back just to kind of see it. I'll have prints hanging up. And this time I brought the portfolio for people to flip through that will say images available, prints available of all these images at these sizes. Because people that really want some of your work want to even just be able to see your stuff, even if they're not going to buy anything. They want to see what you've got. You're probably going to entice them by looking through something. But they also love to dig. Gen Con, not so much, because most of the people there were there to buy games. They were there to play games, buy games. It's a gaming industry convention. But at any of the other genre shows, they spent their money. They're there to experience everything in the show, even if it means seeing, oh, I kind of like that, and then flipping through. They love to flip through stuff. And it might be that random wacky thing that they go, oh, it may even be the print that you've got all over your table. And everywhere else they go, this is really cool. But they only saw it because they were rummaging. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, obviously, I collect things. I'm a thing collector. And I love the hunt and the thrill and finding something really, really great that you weren't expecting. And there's some merit to that, but it all comes down to space, how you're presenting yourself, and really who your target audience is. It may not be a 45-year-old mother of five who has a dragon cat on her shoulder. You know, it might be. You know, I don't know. There's nothing.
But she might want a sketch of that tat on a playmat.
You know, it's true. And I've got some crazy crap that's in my stuff just because I've had people ask me to draw before. Or they said, oh, it'd be great if you did this. Or we were goofing off and said, that's really cool. So I throw it in there. It's a little shamelessly, but people like it. People want it. Somebody's going to come along and literally buy that picture of a dragon playing with a cat and a ball of yarn. You know, that's my sellout, but it was just like, all right, let's do it. Let's rock this. I'm here to make money. I'm here to sell you what you want, not to sit here and hold a high horse. I have my lines, but anyway, that's a different podcast entirely.
Yeah, your boundaries may be like a too big a topic to really cover in this podcast.
Mark, you touched on a really good point there too, though, about the sketching thing. And a lot of people make really good money at sketching at these conventions. And
yeah.
You can cover your meals. You can cover even your hotel room on $5, $10, $15 sketches because people will fly, will keep you busy. If you're sitting there sketching, a lot of times they'll come up with a book or a playmat and say, hey, what would you charge to do this? You know?
I was blown away by this being my first con. Somebody came up and said, hey, would you draw, you know, they really like this one piece. They said, would you draw a sketch of that on a playmat? And I said, sure. And he left it with me and he went to go do something else. And I, you know, I turned to Caroline Himmelman and I was like, what, do I charge for this? She's like, yeah, you charge that.
Better charge for that.
And people, you know, and it feels weird to me. I'm like, oh, well, I am just sitting here drawing. I don't know. But it's a service. You have to value your work. And B, actually, people really expect to pay for it. It's not a mystery to people that you're going to charge for it. They just want to know how much. I mean, this guy came back and I didn't actually ask. I felt bad because I didn't set a price with him before. But, you know, he handed me a wad of cash, not a big wad. It was like one bill. It was one small bill. But it was it was probably more than I would have asked for. I didn't really know what the hell I was doing. And then everybody after that, it was really easy. They come by and they say, oh, you know, I've got this magic card that I've acetated off the art. Can you put a piece of your art on it? And, you know, they say, and I just say, you know, sure. And I name a price. And they were like, cool.
Right. It's hard to predict, too, what people will be willing to pay for those things. I've had people where, you know, I thought I did something that I would ask maybe 15 or 20 bucks for, and somebody will drop 80 on you or something. Just it's a total crapshoot. And this year I tried for the first time putting a tip jar, and we went back and forth at a number of other artists. We sort of talking about it. And
I remember talking to you about that. Yeah.
The whole tip jar thing. And I think a friend of mine is the one who did it at another convention recently. And when I saw the wad of money, the big pile of cash he had in there, it was like he was out raking leaves or something. It's crazy.
I did it too, and I felt really weird about it, but it totally works.
I felt weird at first, and I used to sort of come up with a set price for sketches, and I have a suggested kind of price range at this point, but most of the time I'm kind of now just saying, you know, just throw some money in the tip jar. And sometimes you don't make a lot, and then sometimes you're surprised at how much you make. So it's sort of
it evens out that way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And now the other thing about Gen Con and Gen Con's kind of specific or a little bit interesting in the way that it does this, but when you are an artist at the Gen Con convention, any item above $3, you have to fill out a slip and send them up to a cash register. And sometimes there's a line a mile long up there.
It's a deterrent sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It is. And the sketches, I don't know if this is PC or not. I don't feel obligated to do that with the sketches just because they're, as you said, it's a service, and I'm not selling a specific item. They're bringing me a piece of paper. They're bringing me a playmat, and I'm drawing on it.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why they have their register is because there's sales tax in Indiana and they want to record that. They obviously, they take a cut. They want to record that. Right. And you know, they don't need to take a cut if it's a service. It's the same thing, you know, like if I sell prints, you know, if I sell prints in New York, or if somebody buys an original in New York, I have to charge New York sales tax. But, you know, if somebody buys a print off of my website from, you know, Georgia, they don't have to pay New York sales tax because they're not actually buying a good in New York, and they're not, you know, and it's almost like not even a good, it's not even a physical good in some senses, because it's like a service. They're purchasing the printing of this thing. It gets a little bit tricky, but I think Lars, I think you're right when it comes to Gen Con, that those kinds of activities, I don't think you need to send someone up with a receipt for.
Right. Specifically Gen Con, for those out there who are thinking about getting into this stuff, it doesn't matter where they buy stuff. You're actually supposed to register your sales usage and goods and tax for the states you sell in. So you can choose to do what you want to do, and some things are worth the hassle that might be reaped because of that. But I'm just saying, for any of those potential goers out there who think about all these things, they're taking our advice, they're running with it. We're talking specifically about Gen Con, their processes.
It's different from your taxes. You report your taxes however you want.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This is how we do things. I would hate for anybody to go, oh, but then don't start off with that. There's a whole big ball of mess that goes with
If you have questions about taxes, go get a tax advisor. Ask them.
Please. Yeah.
I have a tax advisor. She saves my life every year. Whatever I pay her, and I like to, she just takes it out of the thing. It's worth it.
Just don't quote any of us.
Yeah.
Please, for the love of God.
But they said,
unless it's the other Grant, the popular one, Grant West.
Oi.
So this brings us to the last question that I had on the quote unquote agenda, and it's great that we've got Lars and Eric, who are a little further along the freelance path from me and Aaron and Grant. But you know, one thing that came up at Gen Con, we were sitting up in one of the rooms one night, as we do, and we were drinking, as we do, and
responsibly.
Anyway, I had my pants on at the time. It was, you know, it was early. So, we were talking about, you know, can you make money at this? And we're talking about coming to Gen Con and making money and trying to make the money back from your table. And we're also talking about the fact that we're ignoring a lot of the other costs that go into it, not just at the con, like parking and whatever, but the time that it takes us to make each of these pieces. And, you know, is it possible, and I was talking with Lars about this a little bit earlier, but is it possible in any single genre for any single client or even bigger, is it possible to make a living as a freelance artist, and how? Discuss.
Well, let me jump in one more thing about the whole convention thing. Remember that it's not just to make money. If you're going for the first time, one of the real advantages to some of these conventions is that you do have art directors there.
Yeah.
So remember that you're not only presenting to the buying public, but you're also presenting to potential future clients and potential future long-term clients. At Gen Con, every year that I've ever been there, you've had Wizards of the Coast art directors. You have at the last, boy, as long as I can remember, you've had them for Magic and for Dungeons & Dragons, not to mention all the other vendors out in the hall area. Some of those companies send art directors, some don't, but usually you can go by and at least shop around and see what kind of art they are buying. And that can help you focus your efforts when you're going looking for work. I do think you can make money at these conventions, but you have to remember that the bottom line is it's an investment in getting your name out there. It's advertising. And you have to look at kind of secondarily, do I make my money back from the convention? You may not always, but you're getting your name out there, you're getting name recognition, and you're getting advertising.
Mm-hmm. I think Eric told me when we first met and went to ILLXCON, he called it FaceTime.
Yeah.
You got to get that FaceTime.
Yeah, I mean, just the other part of it is just networking and getting to know everyone a little bit better. And there's nothing wrong with doing that as well, so. Even if you don't make all the money back that you spent to put in to get there and the hotel and all your prints and all that. I mean, don't forget, if you spend all this money on prints and you don't sell them this time, you can sell them next time because you're not going anywhere.
Okay.
Thanks for reminding me of that.
Be real. Thanks.
Dick. One thing that I was impressed by when I was talking with some of the other artists, like, you know, Eric and Lars and John Stanko and Matt Stewart and a bunch of the other guys, is really figuring out what their client base looks like and what their day to day looks like to really make it work. Eric and Lars, do you guys have any advice for folks who are up and coming, you know, about how to balance their clients, like what they really need to do to get a full plate as a freelance artist?
Just got to work on that portfolio. That's all it really comes down to, is getting the work up there so it's good enough to show it around and get yourself noticed by art directors.
And how many clients, you know, what kind of clients do you have? Do you just make a living off of Magic and, you know, World of Warcraft, or what kind of clients do you have?
For me, I do those two, and then I do a few other RPGs every once in a while. And the other part of it is video game concept art. And that's something that definitely helps pay the bills big time. I don't know about Lars, if he works on any of that as well.
Yeah, I don't work specifically for any video game companies, although I do have something coming up in the fall. I also teach at the Rhode Island School of Design. And RISD, yeah. You certainly have to diversify. I think one of the things, I do work for World of Warcraft, and they sort of have a set look. I think one of the things with Magic, for example, though, is the art director there has done a really good job of sort of cycling through different looks and sort of changing things up. The art has just gotten better and better year after year, and they're bringing in new people, and the current look really is a lot. It's sort of this very concept art kind of oriented. It has this feel. It's much more like the stuff you might see on conceptart.org.
Mm-hmm.
But that could change in the next set. You never know. So it's one of those things where you can't count on every set, every block getting work.
Mm-hmm.
So don't assume that if you get Magic work that you've hit the pinnacle and you really, I've done it. I'm there. You know, it's, you never know from set to set. So it's to diversify.
I always feel like I have to keep on going, and at some point they're going to just stop calling, you know?
That actually happened to me with a client where they changed their legal policy on working with freelancers, and I won't bore you with the details, but I had been essentially working there too long according to their new policy, and they didn't give me any more work, and it was like, oh man. So no, you can't. I would agree with you guys. If you've got all or even most of your eggs in one basket, you got to start looking for some other eggs.
Right.
And figuring out a way to balance it. It may feel weird, honestly, to have this really good thing or this good relationship with one company and still be talking to other people, doing work for other people, or even saying no to that company occasionally when they're being so good to you. But they're under no obligation, like you guys have been saying, to hire you next time or even ever again. And right. it's not necessarily personal. It could just be that, you know, they've changed the look or they're looking for something a little different or they like you or whatever, but it's business and things change and you have to be able to roll with it.
And also bear in mind that you've got a person working at the other end of the phone or at the other end of your email. There's an art director there who might decide to switch careers. And I've had, I did work for National Geographic, and all of a sudden they had a big switch up in their art department. And, you know, I was thinking, oh, I made it. This is great. I'm doing paintings for National Geographic. And the art director left, and bam, that's it, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's very easy to sort of get complacent and think, I can stop now. I've hit the mark I wanted to hit. But you really have to keep things rolling.
Yeah. The first professional job I ever got was two Magic the Gathering cards. And I did those.
Better. Let me say, if that's the first professional job you've ever
got.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah, well, I was really, really lucky, and I did those too. But then that was it, because then the art director left, and it took me a few years to get back in there again, just because the art director left, and you know that's a contact that you have to remake, you know. And especially if you're a first timer, and you just did two cards, the new art director is not going to notice you. So, you know, it's true.
That happened to me with Fantasy Flight. I did like five cards for them when I was in college. I don't think they were actually very good, and I think that's why I didn't hear back. But I did eventually get back, and I do work for them now. Now that that art director, whoever that was, probably left and didn't tell them about the ones that I did, which I'm glad about. So that's good. Does anybody else have anything to add on either Gen Con or even just in general advice to new people who are looking to add cons and other things to their repertoire of doing this illustration career thing?
I don't know if it would be helpful to everybody, but on my blog, grantcooley.blogspot.com, I've started reviewing each of the shows I go to, trying to be as unbiased as I can, which is impossible, but trying to just give the lowdown on my experience as an artist going there, aspiring artist, even talking to the other professional artists there, trying to give them a full idea of, is this show worth me taking my work to? Does it have ads there? Does it have just fans? What's the fan base? What's the art show like? How was the art show run? What were the costs? How were they relative to other shows I've attended? And
you really get into it.
Yeah, well, I mean, because I my blog is for 5-6 people out there, I suppose, at this point. But hopefully my path will just keep getting longer and longer, and there'll be people just like me right now wondering where I should go, what I should be doing, how other people have done it. And if I started at the beginning, which is what this is, obviously optimism is trying to prevail here, that they will be able to follow some of those steps or at least have a better guideline than talking to the promoters for the events, because they lie, they pad their numbers, they try and mislead you. There's some of them are great folks, but there are some people that I considered friends that I felt have misled me into attending some of their events, and we don't need any of that. You will take something different away from everybody's review and opinion, but I'm trying to provide one for people that may not know or may have only been to one show where it would say, man, what is this show about? Well, this was recommended to me. I would go out of my way to attend this because of these specific reasons. So it might be helpful. It might not.
That's a great resource, because there are so many little costs that add up very quickly. I look forward to checking that out. I think the other thing that was touched on once already, I'm pretty sure, is just don't beat yourself up. If you don't do well the first time, just use it as, you know, write down what other people are doing that maybe you didn't do. You might have a guy across from you who's just got people in front of his table constantly, and he's raking in the money, and you just decide you're a failure because that's not the way it's working for you. And don't let that stop you from doing it.
Thank
you. The other thing too, I'd suggest if you get a table is make sure you make signs, you know, spell everything out, let everybody know, make sure you have multiple price signs, and, you know, say, have a little sign that says, oh, these are artist proofs, and, you know, we do drawings on the back because they're blank, and don't assume that everyone knows, because some people have never seen it before, and they may purchase something, and just because they read your sign and had no idea in the first place.
That's a good point. Yeah, you had a great big sign.
What was it,
Drew Baker? DrewBaker.com.
Oh my God! Yeah, Drew had to take his down.
Yeah, no,
it was
no
too.
Crap.
It was too much. No, it wasn't too big, Eric. Don't worry.
No, it was perfect.
You haven't ever heard that. No, what? Oh,
I'm totally gonna wait. I'm backing out of that one.
Hey. No comment.
Yeah, that saves some editing time.
Well, I was wondering about price tags versus just having a little sign versus having it verbal. Does that
set prices?
I think for, I don't know. I mean, I didn't have any kind of sign, and I did okay. But I would say if I were to do it again, I would probably have tags on the stuff that's hanging, like, you know, the stuff that's like originals or, you know, limited edition kind of stuff. Cause that, I mean, frankly, I feel like it lends a little bit of legitimacy to the uniqueness of the piece, that it's got its own price tag. And things for prints, you know, you just say various sizes. You know, and I saw people had, you know, I think, Grant, you had like a little sheet that just basically laid out the prices, and it was easy for people to make a decision. And they didn't feel like they had to. I feel like a lot of people, and I do this too, a lot of people sort of walk by your table, and if they don't feel like they can quickly understand what's going on, then you might want to talk to them so they'll just move on quickly.
Right. And I think also if you have somebody who comes up and they're curious about the price of something, they might be a little embarrassed to ask because
they don't want to talk to you. God, most of the attendees, they just want to be able to buy stuff, look at it, that, you know, you make eye contact with them and they scatter. And it can be intimidating. You know, it's like going to a yard sale. You walk into somebody's yard, you're rummaging through their stuff. You don't want to talk to them. Some people do, and it's great. And I enjoy a lot of the conversations I've had. I love it when people engage me. I want to talk about my work. I want to talk about me. But if you're buying something personal from somebody right there, it's almost better if you have – it's great when you have an assistant that they can be like, I'm not the artist. Then most people get so much more chatty. But if you're the guy, they're just like, well, maybe they don't want to buy it. Maybe they do. Maybe they're on the fence, but they feel pressured because you're right there. So they got to be able to get in and get out, have things clearly marked, set it up. If you got original paintings, I didn't have mine at this last show, but I normally have gallery tags that I'll hang with stuff that gives a description of it, the name, the price. So they've got a little something to check out, maybe get a little more engaged before they even ask that first question. So,
yeah.
Thoughts?
We're about out of time here. Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Lars, for joining us on this special edition Gen Con podcast. It's great having you guys.
Thanks for calling.
For
thank
sure.
you.
Yeah, we'll just I'll fade to black and do music.
Thanks again for listening. We invite you to visit drawntoday.com for links to our members and their work, as well as an archive of previous episodes. You can also subscribe to the Drawn Today podcast on iTunes. If you have a comment, question, or topic suggestion, please send it to drawntoday@gmail.com. Drawn Today is a proud member of the Visual Artists Podcast Network.com, where you can find other great podcasts about art and illustration. We'd like to thank Zoe Keating for the music for this episode. You can find more information about her and her music at zoekeating.com.